Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today we'll be visiting with the recent executive director of FNVW, that's Friends for a Nonviolent World, Leah Robshaw Robinson. Leah's first years with FNVW were as the volunteer engagement specialist, and early during COVID, she took the executive director post, where she oversaw and facilitated their programs like AVP, that's Alternatives to Violence Project, People Camp, and the Everyday Nonviolence podcast, and much more. Her prep for her social activism work included her BA in the History of Social Resistance and Transformation from Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. She recently moved to working with Avivo, whose mission is to increase well-being through recovery and career advancement while working to end homelessness. I'm grateful for Andrew Jansen's production assistance today. We head now to Minneapolis, Minnesota, via Zoom for our visit with Leah Robshaw Robinson. Leah, thank you so very much for joining me for Spirit in Action.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mark. Thanks for the invitation.
And there was a few months run-up to this, in part because August, when you finished your service with Friends for Nonviolent World, you were very busy. And I think you needed to recuperate after that. How many years did you serve with FNVW?
I was there about 6 years. First as the volunteer engagement specialist for a couple years, and then as the executive director for the last 4 years.
Which was more draining for you, volunteer specialist or being the director?
I would say that being an executive director requires more energy and investment of life. However, I have a philosophy that we get out of things what we put into them. And because I was putting so much of myself and my energy into being an executive director, I also got a tremendous return on that investment, and it probably had more of an impact on me as a person in that role.
Theoretically, I think it was not a full-time position, but in actuality?
Yeah, absolutely. It was started out 20 hours a week, and then it did end up evolving to a 40-hour week position due to a contract we got with Hennepin County to do youth violence prevention services. However, I think with this work of social change, organizing, and any kind of community-based work, it's always a tension between the need that exists and capacity. And so that's a dance that I sometimes did really well, and sometimes I think I overextended. And you know, that's part of the learning, I think, of doing this work.
Your hair does not appear to be gray, so your overextension must have been supplemented by nutrition from the work?
There you go. Yeah, I was definitely nourished by a lot of people in the organization, and I think that is something that's super important for me and for most folks who are working on nonviolent social change, is that it's done in community, 100%, that we are standing on the shoulders of so many people who have come before us, who paved the way and gave us wisdom that we get to apply in our work. And then we have so many people alongside us that really makes it possible.
Let's talk about FNVW, Friends for Nonviolent World. Again, you had 6 years working with them. Describe that organization to the world. I believe it started when American Friends Service Committee closed their regional office that they had in Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And then Friends locally said, no, we need to keep this kind of work going. So FNVW was born.
Yeah, FNVW is a great example of true grassroots organizing and the Quaker community wanting to have a space to have an expression of Quaker values in the community. The work that Friends for a Nonviolent World has done over the years has evolved. But during my time there, we were really focused on using the principles and practices of nonviolence to transform conflict and to address the root causes of violence. The programs that we were running were really locally based, looking at how do we support folks who've experienced violence, which is really all of us, and also who have caused violence, which is also all of us, in growing our skill set for engaging conflict in ways that can be productive, and thinking about our own trauma and our own life story, doing some of the healing work that we need to do in order to have a healthy relationship with people around us. in addition to having tools for making social change and intervening in situations where we're witnessing violence that may be happening to other people.
So how does FNVW do this? Peace is a great aspiration, but when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, there's a lot of details and a lot of working parts.
Totally. In terms of how FNVW fits into the landscape, we have a couple programs that have been long running in our organization. One of them is the Alternatives to Violence Project. This is actually conflict transformation workshops that got their start through a collaboration between Quakers and inmates at Greenhaven Prison in upstate New York, who developed this curriculum to try to address the revolving door that they saw at their institution, where youth were appearing in prison for fairly minor offenses, only to return for increasingly more serious violent crimes because there wasn't anything happening in a prison environment that was resourcing people to have a life other than what got them into prison in the first place. So this curriculum drew upon the work of the civil rights movement and a lot of the trainings that had happened in the civil rights movement. Also took some of the values and principles that Quakerism has to offer around we all have inherent dignity, we all have inherent worth, and reaching with empathy towards one another as being an important part of addressing conflict. So I guess one thing about AVP workshops is that they're very grassroots oriented. You become a part of it through invitation. There's no prerequisites required to be in a workshop, and there's no prerequisites required to become an AVP facilitator other than having an interest in the work and a personal commitment to doing what you can to live into AVP's values, which is building community through cooperation, through trust, through reaching for the good in others, through using humor, using surprise. Like, there's a variety of strategies that are very concrete tools taught in AVP workshops. They're very experiential, and they pull upon the life and stories and needs that the people in the workshop identify. So role plays, scenarios are coming from people's lived experiences.
AVP, again, that's Alternatives to Violence Project, and we'll have the website, avpusa.org. And of course, there are links to this from the fnvw.org website of Friends for Nonviolent World.
That's right, fnvw.org/AVP.
And so you can find out about AVP there. My understanding, though, is that AVP, it started off, as you said, with work within prisons, but it has multiplied and gone to many facets of the world. I've done interviews with people using AVP-derived work in East Africa, like in Rwanda and so on. And there's special ways that it's been used in the Twin Cities of Minnesota as well. Talk about that migration and, again, how this really works. I've done the basic AVP course, so I do have some knowledge of it, but I'm sure you've got a lot more.
AVP's effectiveness spread through word of mouth from its origin at Greenhaven Prison in New York. It was really making an impact on the lives of the people in that prison system. And it's actually prison staff who started to tell their colleagues at other facilities about what was going on. And through word of mouth, it has expanded across the United States and around the world. Really, if somebody's done an AVP workshop and it has made an impact, it's like once you experience it, you see how it could be applied in every community you're a part of. And so all it really takes is two AVP facilitators being in any geographic place together to start an AVP program in their location. So it's very versatile in that way. I mean, it is credentialed. You do go through a pretty rigorous training process of like 64 hours of workshops at least, plus more additional mentoring and support. But it has stood the test of time. I mean, it started in 1975. So we're coming up on our 50th anniversary. Before the pandemic, workshops are being offered in 35 states and 60 countries, including the Twin Cities and Minnesota through FNVW's hosting of this program.
It still probably sounds fairly nebulous to our Spirit in Action listeners. What does it actually accomplish? I mean, I cherish a lot of the light and livelies that are part of it. It's not heavy on lecture, and yet I read an article that was in a Friends journal at one point, and it started with this woman who was in prison, who became part of this group, and at the end of it, having been transformed by it, she talked about giving up the shiv that she had made to do violence with, that it had changed her so that violence was not going to happen. That's an amazing transformation to have. And yet, do we actually have studies of the effectiveness and the effect of what these workshops are accomplishing?
There are some studies that have been done that look at folks' anger management capacity increasing through participation in an AVP workshop. And in terms of how FNVW evaluates the program, we ask people if they believe they can use what they learned in the workshop in their life. And not only in their life, but like how soon can you start applying some of the things that you've learned? I don't have the statistics exactly on hand, but it's something like 90%+ of people can use it within 1 week or less, because these are things that we need as humans to interact with one another. So AVP is experiential, as I mentioned, and central to AVP is this concept of transforming power, which is this power that works within us that allows us to transform violent or potentially violent, unhealthy relationships, attitudes, or lifestyles into more positive, healthy, nonviolent ones. This power is available in each of us, but it has to be developed and nurtured in an environment of trust and support. That's really what the AVP workshop setting provides. They're an intensive, often 3-day retreat. And within this space, participants can really start to explore how violence has impacted them personally, share their experiences with other people, and in that human connection, and not only human connection, but human connection in a space that's really affirming and non-judgmental, people can open up about experiences they've had that they've never talked to anybody about ever in their life. And there's something very important about being able to be seen and being able to express some of our hardest, most scariest parts of our life, and to have it be received with compassion and support. And not only that, but to have like a community of people who are like, we're here with you. We can do this together. We're a community. Let's role play that. Let's just honor that, what you shared. That human connection, I think, can be very transformative for people in a world that can be very isolating for a lot of people.
Some of the words sound kind of, I don't want to demean my own affiliation, but nice sounding word like that. But there are concrete measures like recidivism, people in prison. It actually drastically reduces recidivism in those who become part of, engaged in this AVP work. It's kind of amazing that it can do that. You were speaking of something else that I thought was important. The language that you used, or that is used in the workshops, is the transforming power. They don't say God. They don't say higher power. They say transforming power.
Right.
My experience has been, I know in the Twin Cities, at least some of the members of AVP training are Muslim, or a wide variety, or non-religious completely. What part does religion play in this?
I think the role that religion plays is really more the influence of the Quakers who helped co-create the curriculum. That sense of, even though it is not, it's sort of the implicitly underlying understanding that we all have an inner light within us. We are all part of creation together. Therefore, we all have a level of inherent dignity and worth. That worldview is absolutely rooted in, I think, most spiritual practices and most world religions, this understanding of seeing one another as humans.
There's a member of a weekly men's group that I'm part of who does prison ministry. It's Christian prison ministry, right? And I think that to some degree, those programs have good effects also on people while they're in and when they get out to some degree. Is there some difference you've noticed about those kind of groups, which are often happening in prisons right alongside a AVP workshop?
What I have observed around sometimes the Christian or religious oriented work is it's very personal in nature, and I'm not an expert on it, but I think something that could be unique about AVP is that it's both understanding one's own life and coming to terms with how we've lived our life. Sometimes things we're proud of, sometimes things we really have a lot of regret around, but it's also rooted in this broader context of, I'm trying to think, maybe it's just that there's multiple paths, not multiple ways to get to the same place. And it doesn't need to be so much tied to a particular understanding of God or how God operates. It's more the way that we live our life. And again, I mean, I think that religious practice is one way that people come to have a sense of values that they root into that guides how they show up in the world and do good things and live in positive ways.
Now, you were the director for the Friends for Nonviolent World in the Twin Cities. So everybody knows Leah Robshaw Robinson served that valuable role, particularly through COVID. Does that mean you were also leading teaching AVP workshops, or was that just you organizing people to do that?
I did mostly support the workshops happening and the facilitator team offering the workshops. And when I stepped into executive director, we were going through sort of a big transition because it was during the pandemic in October 2020 is when I became executive director. And at that time, we were not doing anything in prisons because they were on lockdown, just like we all kind of were. So we adapted workshops to happen on a Zoom platform instead, which was pretty rad. The creativity that facilitators brought to that, it allowed us to do workshops with folks around the United States and internationally. There was all this cross-pollination that happened during that time. I think one of the silver linings of lockdown was suddenly the whole world became connected through Zoom. And so we did workshops online that way. So I was just supporting the logistical behind the scenes pieces of that. But I did end up becoming a trained facilitator over the course of my time at FNVW because it is such a powerful program. And not just me, but my oldest son also is a trained facilitator as well by doing the three-part workshop series. And maybe I'll back up just a second, restate a little bit what AVP is, because I'm not sure my first answer was that articulate. So traditional AVP workshops are intensive 2 or 3 day learning experiences that are done in groups of 12 to 20 participants. And in each workshop, 2 or 3 facilitators lead participants through a carefully planned series of exercises that are designed to build trust and a sense of community within the group. Through circle processes, role plays, and interactive activities, participants have this guided experience of deep personal reflection, vulnerable sharing with others, both one-on-one and in small groups and in large groups. And these activities are interspersed with grounding work for anxiety, light and lively activities that just bring some play and fun and relieve the fatigue of the hard emotional work that is going on in the workshop and help build camaraderie amongst participants. This facilitated process means that the learning is coming from the group. And even the people who are facilitating the workshop will say that they are learners and they get something from every workshop, in addition to the participants taking valuable insights and learning from their experience in the workshop too.
Yeah, it is a wonderful experience. The thing that I was amazed by was essentially prisoners are locked up. They can't get away from it, right? It gives them something to do in what can be an oppressive, scary, painful place to be, boring as well. So the places where this Alternatives to Violence program training has been carried have really excited me. I've done interviews, and again, if people come to northernspiritradio.org, on the website, just search for AVP, and you'll find interviews I did with people in East Africa. So we're talking about people who were part of the genocide, who were victims of the genocide, gathering in these kinds of circles. And as you say, building camaraderie with people who were killing my family. It's an amazing experience. I understand that in the Twin Cities, at least at one point, AVP programs were being used with some gangs. Do you know about this? Was this during your tenure?
It was before my time, but I can see how it would work. Because one of the things that I can say is that AVP creates a very unique environment. One example of this, I've heard at least 2 of our facilitators who became AVP facilitators while they were incarcerated. These are African-American men, have told me that prisons are a recruiting ground for Aryan Nation, for white supremacy organizations, white nationalist organizations. It's like a little petri dish. Inevitably, when you're doing an AVP workshop, there are people who come to the workshop who are members of these organizations and so committed to the point that they will have like a swastika tattoo on their body. It's almost this, like, you say you accept everybody. But what I've learned, and actually there was one of the programs that FNVW did for a long time, was this Everyday Nonviolence podcast. And Shelley Totchluck did an episode on understanding white supremacist movements. And one of the things that we are learning is that white supremacist movements, just like any extremist organization, is very strategic in who is recruited. People who are recruited are people who are lonely, who are isolated, who are not woven into the fabric of society in healthy ways and don't have community. And that's what need is being met by these. It's a need of belonging and identity and sometimes safety. And all those needs can really be met by a white supremacist organization in prison. But in really, people are sacrificing a lot of their own self when they do that, right? When we base our identity on a system of hate. So here's this AVP workshop that's providing an authentic community where there is authentic care about individuals who are there and true empathy towards what people's life experience has been and a sense of curiosity towards one another, people who are different, people who are really your opponent in other situations like these Black facilitators. A white supremacist is definitely an opponent in their world, right?
Right.
However, the environment that's cultivated in this 24 hour of time together on a weekend, these Black men told me, like, this is the only time they've ever seen somebody who was a member of the Aryan Nation back away from that identity in a way that actually was like sustainable long term. Because once you really shared heart to heart connection with a Black person, for example, or had a community really see who you are, all the othering and the dehumanization that's required to support that level of hate becomes like there's too much cognitive dissonance that goes on in someone's heart. And when you think about the hate and the violence that is existing in the United States right now, there's great research done by some folks here in the Twin Cities. The organization is called the Violence Project. They've created a mass shooting database with the goal of understanding how we can prevent this mass shooting epidemic that's taking place in our country. They've done a lot of research to understand what is the personality profile of somebody who becomes a mass shooter. And as I mentioned during the pandemic, we had this opportunity to connect with so many people on Zoom in so many ways. So I went to a presentation that they did. And something that really struck me is how this sense of isolation, I remember when thinking about school shootings, for example, and I'm a parent, I have a 9-year-old and 11-year-old go to a public school in Minneapolis. And the thing about school shootings, if you look at who's actually committing a school shooting, it's actually current or former students of that school. Like 91% of these 134 school shootings that they've tracked are kids who went to that school. So they already know the building. They already know all the Code Red trainings. 87% of them were in crisis prior to the shooting. 80% were suicidal prior to the shooting. And 78% of them leaked plans ahead of time. So in the case of school shootings, if we as a community are paying attention to one another and being present to one another, the warning signs are there. That is something that AVP offers in terms of like what you say, preventing recidivism or just understanding what gets people to places where they may cause great harm. Often it's just operating so disconnected from people who are paying attention to you or caring about you that it can get so extreme and nobody's there to like show up for you and be there for you like as an alternate voice of what other choices are available. And so AVP provides this community that just gives people an out, right? It gives people an opportunity to think about what else could be a different possibility for my life and people who are there alongside you. Because you can do the workshops and then you can become a facilitator if you really find this is a community that's helpful to your own growth and something that's valuable to you.
And folks, we're speaking Alternatives to Violence Project, which is simply one of the kinds of work that Friends for Nonviolent World in the Twin Cities does. Their website, fnvw.org. We're speaking with Leah Robshaw Robinson today. She's the former executive director. She just left a couple months ago, and she's on to more work. We're going to delve into that, but I did want to remind you, you're listening to Spirit in Action. Our website, northernspiritradio.org, which is very helpful when you want to track down my guests and the organizations they're connected with. So come to northernspiritradio.org. You can find out more about Leah Robshaw Robinson, FNVW, AVP, and all of the other guests I've had for these 19 plus years. I've been doing these programs, both Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul. When you do visit, please remember to post a comment. We love your two-way communication. We need to hear from you. Without your voice, our work is not complete. So please help us out that way. Also, there's a way you can donate. That's particularly key right now. As of this month, I don't have enough to do payroll or to cover our expenses, even renewing our computer resources we have. So we need your donations right now. Even more so, though, I'd say it's more important to support your local community radio stations. We're broadcast on some 35 stations across the USA, and they're doing valuable local work, just like the Friends for Nonviolent World does in the Twin Cities. Community radio stations provide music and local insight, issues of interest to the local community, because one size does not fit all. And community radio stations make a big difference. So support them with your hands, with your wallet, and support Northern Spirit Radio if you're able. Again, Leah Robshaw Robinson is here. We've talked to Leah about FNVW's work with AVP, Alternatives to Violence Project, but that's only one of many projects that you've been involved with. Can you name some of the others that over your tenure, your 6 years working with FNVW that you experienced and probably were in charge of and made succeed?
I would love to. And I just want to add one thing related to the school shooting piece is that in addition to the AVP workshops in prisons, FNVW does do workshops in the community, and in the last year started focusing on community AVP workshops for youth, really identifying that what an AVP workshop has to offer, both the community, the skill building, the mentorship, and the healthy relationships are so valuable for our young people, especially young people that are struggling in school or struggling to feel a sense of belonging and connection in other places in their life. So that's been a very exciting initiative that FNVW began, because we recognize there's a definite need for community to step in and support youth and also to support parents. Maybe you've heard when the Surgeon General was talking about how we need a fundamental shift in how our country values and promotes the mental health and well-being of caregivers, because caregivers are under so much stress right now, trying to raise healthy children in the context of a lot of forces that are really negatively impacting kids' mental health right now.
But then I was asking you, Leah, about the other kinds of work programs, activities that are sponsored by FNVW. Again, the organization you were formerly executive director of, you can now speak fully and completely.
Well, you know, I love FNVW, and I told the board and everybody who I have formed close relationships with over my time at FNVW that I'm stepping away from being an FNVW staff member, but I will always be a part of the FNVW community. And in part, it's because of one of the longest running programs that FNVW has run, which is our People Camp program. People Camp is this week-long intergenerational community living experience that was originally started by American Friends Service Committee, as you mentioned. That was a Quaker-based organization here in the Twin Cities that preceded the creation of Friends for a Nonviolent World. And FNVW took on offering that program when we formed as an organization. And we've run it ever since. So it's been running for over 50 years. One of the values of this space, it's a chance to kind of live into this alternate reality that we're hoping to be creating. You know, I'm an organizer at heart. And if you think about, like, how does social change happen? There's a really awesome model that Bill Moyer and George Lakey and Training for Change have around how we do social justice movement building type work. And there's different types of people. There's the helpers, there's the advocates, there's the rebels, and then there's the organizers. And the organizers are the people who are getting folks together to do the work and also trying to think about, like, what is the goal here? What is our aim? What is the end vision of something different than what currently exists? Something that is more equitable, that's compassionate, that nourishes us, that isn't based on a sense of, like, commodification of all things of life, but has a wholeness around who we are as people. So People Camp kind of is this opportunity to experiment with that. We get together. Anyone who wants to can come, and we figure out how to be a community, and we cook for each other. We clean for each other. We lead social justice workshops. There's singing, there's recreation, childcare opportunities are there for parents and caregivers. So we can have some rest and respite, but also just a chance to connect and reflect on what our next year is going to be, what our hopes and dreams are for our life and our work. That's a really valuable community to me, and my kids have been coming with me as well. And it's very unique in that it is an intergenerational community space. So that's a beautiful program that I think kind of cultivates some of those relationships that then get translated into the organizing work that happens in the community that FNVW is a part of. There's two other things that were a part of the way FNVW lived into its mission during my time as executive director. One of them was the Everyday Nonviolence podcast, of which Spirit in Action has actually rebroadcasted a couple of our episodes, which has really been really great.
It's great material and wonderful work that goes into it. I'm really happy to be able to host it periodically here on Northern Spirit Radio.
The Everyday Nonviolence podcast is really about demystifying how social change happens and how nonviolence can be used by all of us and lifting up the work of individuals in the community who are like living, breathing neighbors who can be contacted directly and you can have a conversation with them. You can support their work. There's something cool about realizing that we're all just humans in the end working on this together. That podcast was really fun to produce and has now is sort of this library of resources on all different sorts of topics around making change, different areas and spaces using nonviolence. The other thing that FNVW has been a part of, at least for part of the time during my time at FNVW, was looking at reimagining public safety. As executive director, stepping into my role during the pandemic, following the murder of George Floyd, following the uprising, there was a lot of conversations in the Twin Cities around how do we continue doing this work? And I learned a lot about stages of social movements during that time. I was volunteer engagement specialist when the uprising was happening, for example, and there were elders in the Quaker community and the organizing community that really taught me a lot about how you can use a flashpoint like that to build on decades of work that's already been going on around raising awareness of police brutality against Black and Brown people, understanding how what keeps us safe might not actually be a police response, but there's other strategies available that can create public safety in ways that are actually more effective. So Friends for a Nonviolent World joined up with a whole coalition of organizations that were working on that. And one of the initiatives was this Yes on Two ballot amendment. It was a ballot vote to create a different department of public safety in the city of Minneapolis, of which the police force would be one part, one tool, but there would be a whole myriad of other resources and funded resources of ways to invest in safety in our community. So that was pretty amazing, both to be a part of like 50 other organizations all coming together to work on something in a coalition environment. And then also the relational organizing that FNVW did. We hosted a conversation for our little community, our FNVW community, about public safety, created space for people to talk about what that meant to them and some of the ideas they had. And then as individuals, we hosted things in our own neighborhoods and spaces as well. And even though that did not pass, the amount of awareness around the need for addressing the way that police systems target Black people historically and presently disproportionately compared to white people, and also thinking about how what keeps us safe actually might be us, that we keep us safe. And AVP actually is like one piece of that puzzle. I really do believe that giving us the tools to have that hard personal, maybe conflict conversation with our neighbor whose dog is barking in the middle of the night to try to find a resolution between ourselves versus picking up the phone and calling the police with a noise complaint, which is outsourcing the problem to a system that uses force to resolve conflict, can set people up to be in very unsafe situations. So that was something that I found very meaningful. And there's still work, a lot of work happening. And actually, like a lot of fruit of that labor is growing in Ramsey County and in Hennepin County in what sorts of resources are being allocated to different response models for a 911 call and different ways people can ask for help besides calling for a police officer if they don't feel personally resourced to handle what's going on.
Yes, FNVW has done so many good things over the years at these programs. I urge people to check out fnvw.org. You can subscribe to the Everyday Nonviolence podcast, and we will be hosting them again here on Northern Spirit Radio. Let's talk a little bit wider about the work that you've been doing in your life. Somehow you felt really called to this position, to this work. You're very much still in love with the work of FNVW, but it didn't start there in your life. I think you were already on the trail to being an organizer, certainly, and a social justice peace organizer. Where did this come from in Leah Robshaw Robinson's life?
Love that question mark. And it's been fun to kind of ruminate upon it in preparation for our conversation. I think one thing that has been very influential in my life is how much my parents really relied on community And we're a part of a broader community that helped to raise me. My church community, I mentioned I was grew up in Dayton Avenue Presbyterian Church in St. Paul. That faith community provided me with a whole wide range of adults who cared, leadership opportunities, everything from being the one responsible for gathering up all the little communion cups and the bulletins left in the pews to lighting the candles at the beginning of the service, public speaking by reading scripture and singing in choirs, singing solos, and all in this very nurturing environment that just cared about kids and cared about us feeling loved and growing into ourselves, whatever that was meant to be. So that was very important to me. Also, I was a part of Girl Scouts, and I got involved because my friend in fourth grade invited me to an overnight Girl Scout camp, and I had never done anything like that before. And it opened up this whole wide world of building fires and camping and tying knots and all these wilderness things that were pretty amazing. And so I stayed around with my troop all the way through my senior year of high school. I got my gold award. And in the process of earning all those badges, I was learning a lot about myself, about how you do things, skill development, really. So I think those two places, in addition to youth group leaders and my parents, I mean, my mom especially, be the first to say, like, I'm so grateful for all the other adults who took an interest in you, Leah, because I mean, my parents had a lot going on in their life, and it was really helpful to have a community of support. So that, I think, being rooted in this sense of we don't just belong to a nuclear family, we belong to a neighborhood, we belong to a church, we belong to all these social spaces, shaped me in deep ways and embedded in me a sense of valuing of community that has influenced everything I've done since then. There's a lot of stories I could share, but I think something that is true in the United States, and perhaps is increasingly so, is we've become a bit of a transactional society in the sense that we pay for things and we work to earn money in order to pay for these things. And in that system, it's a very individualistic approach to life. And it can be also a very isolating approach to life, and maybe not even that satisfying or fulfilling. And as some of the associations that had been a part of my life as a kid, a church, Girl Scout troop, these sorts of associations, I think there's less of them in the world, and less kids are necessarily being raised within these contexts of a community. And one thing that's super important about community is it's a place where we can just be ourselves and bring whatever gifts we have to offer to the table. And it doesn't have to be all of us is great, but this one thing is useful to my neighborhood. This one thing is useful to my church, and I'll just bring that. And then other people bring their gifts. And there's this alternate reality of citizenship-based or a relational-based way of living where not everybody on the block needs to have a lawnmower. You can share a lawnmower. Or if you are trying to bake something and you run out of eggs, you can like borrow an egg from your neighbor. You don't necessarily have to like go to the grocery store and buy it. You as an individual, you can share, you can ask for help, you can help each other. You can kind of be in it together as a community. And in a lot of ways, what Friends for a Nonviolent World was doing and what drew me to this volunteer engagement specialist position that got me into that organization was connecting people who had an interest in doing something with this talent that they had or this skill that they had and weaving it into an organization that existed around something they cared about, a mission they cared about of building a just and peaceful world through nonviolence. And I can use my computer programming skills in this space and make a difference and be of use. My job before Friends for a Nonviolent World was as a community education coordinator, running after-school programs for kids and adult community ed programs for the neighborhood. And again, I loved that so much because the after-school teachers and the adult community ed teachers were like, I love music and I would like to share it with the community because I don't get to do it in my job. Or I do it in my job, but I'd like to do it just for fun. And so I will lead an after-school music class or I'll lead a community choir. And providing opportunities for us as humans to bring the things that we love and share it and for to receive the amazing talent that other people have, and not in a expensive way, but in a community-based way where we're just, I'm going to offer what I have and I know you'll offer to me something that will benefit me too. So when I think about the world and I think about what we're trying to create, it's a lot of different frameworks for thinking about social change, but one that I really, really love is an idea that Ricardo Morales Levins put forth. He would call himself a trickster, artist, and activist here in Minneapolis. And he talks about how you can imagine the tree that you want to have. You need to plant the seed, of course, for that tree to grow. But before a seed will germinate, you have to think about what's the soil that the seed is being planted in. And there's parables about this that Jesus shared as well, right? It's this notion of the cultural soil that we're living in will grow the seeds that that culture is conducive to nourishing. And the mindsets we have around what our values are, how we live together, what makes us happy, these are the things that will determine what kinds of plants grow. If we think about some of the narratives here in the United States around the individualized approach to life, where if you're not doing so great, probably because you made a big mistake somewhere along the way. This compost in the soil, the beliefs, ideas, values, and narratives that create the environment in which the seeds we're trying to plant can grow, it's really important to invest in a cultural awareness that will foster equity, will foster seeing each other as humans, will foster empathy and a sense of collective oneness versus a lot of some of the cultural narratives that are working against, I think, peace and justice movements right now are ones that have been put into the soil of our country. Things like, if you're doing well, it's because you earned it. If you're struggling, you probably messed up somewhere and it's your own fault. The inequity that we have towards the way that people are treated around various systems of oppression, like race and class and gender, sexual orientation, just these are all narratives that are really convenient for power holders to keep their power, because we are losing our power when we are othering one another and not coming together for our collective well-being. So I think some of the most amazing things that can happen in doing good community work is you're creating opportunities to really listen and have empathy with folks who are coming from different perspectives and backgrounds. And that really does cultivate a sense of unity that can, or not necessarily unity, it can cultivate a sense of
community.
Of community there. It can cultivate a sense of community that can withstand efforts to divide us from one another in order for power holders to keep their power.
I've observed for a long time how our connection to technology and money, the fact that whether it's daycare, daycare used to be grandma would provide some of the support for your kids and a neighbor would take care of your kids. And having a daycare center to go to certainly can upgrade some of the services, if you will, but it will decrease connection, the building of community. You talked about all the things that are transactional. And one thing I would say is grace and love are not transactional. And we definitely don't help our society when we identify people as their paycheck, people as their job, as their bank account. Grace and love, I think, are essential to a good community, and we've got too little of that going around. And so you've been working on the side of grace and love, I think, is that's what I'd like to say about Leah Robshaw Robinson. So how did you get to this work? You talk about, Girl Scouts and the Presbyterian Church. You're part of the wonderful community nurture you got out of those, the skills. How did that transform into this actual work that you did? I don't think Girl Scouts taught you how to be executive director of FNDW.
Good question. It was interesting when our executive director at Friends for Nonviolent World resigned, and the board was trying to decide, okay, who will be a good successor? They're like, Leah. And I was like, no way. Oh my gosh, no. I know how much work that is. No. And then I kept thinking about it. And I realized, you know what? If not now, when? If not now, me, who? And I think it's really important for us to remember that change is not done by people who feel fully qualified or who are perfect or who are amazing. It's really done by just humans who care and feel compelled to lend their power and whatever wisdom they have to the work because they believe in something. And think Ella Baker is just such a great role model for this in the way she approached her organizing work in the civil rights movement. She coined the term spade work, which is essentially like you do leadership development in the community of the people who are most impacted by whatever's going on. And you organize by cultivating capacity in folks who don't necessarily see themselves as part of a movement or qualified in whatever that might mean to do any particular type of leadership role. So for me, I was like, okay, you know, I'm not alone in this. And that's the thing. It's like, we're not alone in this. And so I stepped into that role because I had a sense of community and because I had a sense of, I have other people who are with me in this who will support me. And there were many people who I relied on heavily for ideas, for guidance, for knowledge, organizational history, wisdom about how to proceed. And because FNBW also it was founded by Quakers, it relies a lot on collective decision-making innately too, which took the pressure off a little bit as well, to know that there's folks in this organization who are familiar with consensus, that there's not a sense of the executive director must know all things. And, you know, I had a whole team of people that I worked with. So in some ways, that sense of community identity helped a lot in taking on that role. And if there's anything that I can emphasize in my conversation with you is that we all do have a role to play and we all have power to make change. And it's important for each of us to figure out what that thing is that makes us come alive, that gets us excited, because there's many reasons to have despair. And I think it can become, the anxiety can become paralyzing when we think about all the things that we're kind of up against as a society. But hope really does come through action. And I just believe my life has been so much richer by deciding that I'm just going to do what I can within the sphere of my influence and the relationships I've forged, the things that I've learned, and the fun that I've had. Being a part of different organizing and movement work has given me hope and has kept my spirits alive. And that's important as a parent to believe that a different future is possible for my kids. And that's only going to happen if we roll up our sleeves and take action.
I still think you must have had some training on this. Were you an organizational major at college? How did you do this? I mean, or were you just an English lit major?
So I went to Earlham College, which I was drawn there by the Quaker values. They resonated so strongly with what I believed in. And it's a college founded by Quakers in Richmond, Indiana. And in that space, I had some amazing professors. And it was a liberal arts college that allowed me to craft my own major so that I could take all the classes that I wanted from my most favorite professors and turn it into like a degree. I created a major called the History of Social Resistance and Transformation. And I did a women's studies minor as well. And I think the thing that happened at Earlham was I understood that change is more than just me as an individual making an individual consumer choice that was in alignment with my values. Change happens because people organize and put pressure on power holders and disrupt the status quo so much that something has to change. And sometimes that can happen by a whole bunch of individuals deciding they're going to make a different consumer choice. Like boycotting a corporation is a very effective form of nonviolent direct action, but only if a whole bunch of other people are also doing it. And the only way to get a whole bunch of other people to do that is to organize and build a campaign to put that pressure collectively on that corporation to change. So at Earlham, I learned a lot more about organizing strategy and also a lot more about my own awareness of my identity as a woman and who I am in the world outside of this little community that I grew up in, how I fit into the landscape of US culture, where my privilege lies, where my places where I am experiencing oppression, and just that whole intersectionality of my identity. That was a big formative time in my life for those things as well.
So that's a bit about how you got from Girl Scouts, Presbyterian Church, to your work with FNVW. And now it's been a couple months past that you actually finished your term as executive director for FNVW. Where are you going now?
I realized that I was ready to take a pause from some of the big system leadership roles and hone my skills a little bit more in the one-on-one relationship. I was lucky enough during the pandemic to be introduced to this place called the Center for Holding Space. It's an organization that was co-founded by a really amazing woman named Heather Plett. I did their holding space training program. Then just last year, I completed their certification program. And through that training, I gained a lot of skills for holding space, which is essentially like creating a container in which an individual or a community can go through a process of discernment. I think in Quaker tradition, there's things like a clearness committee. It's kind of like that, you know, letting people really explore possibilities. There's this idea called liminal space where things kind of have to fall apart for us to emerge into a new space in our life. And it's important to have those transitions because that's how we evolve as a person. If we didn't ever have crisis moments or situations where we realize like this is not working for me, something has to change, but I do not know how. That's where having a process for someone who can hold space can be of tremendous value, because that's somebody who can create a container in which those hard questions can be asked, in which the vulnerabilities, the insecurities, the anxieties, all those things can surface, and we can process through those pieces to get to the next thing in our life. Sometimes those liminal times are things we have no choice about too. But in any case, I guess I really realized I love holding space. I love facilitating groups, and I wanted to do something with an individual level. So I knew that. And I also was looking for a job where I could have a little more time to spend with my own kids who are growing up way too fast. And So I'm really excited that I now have a job as a career counselor for an organization in the Twin Cities called Avivo. Avivo's mission is really to end homelessness, and they have a number of programs that they use to accomplish this. They provide pathways to housing and housing supports for individuals experiencing homelessness here in the Twin Cities. They provide chemical and mental health services in a really integrated way that helps individuals and families achieve long-lasting recovery and wellness. And they have employment and career education services. So that's where I fit in. And my role is to be a coach and a counselor for folks who are between jobs with the dislocated worker program, which means they've been laid off or they're receiving unemployment benefits, but those are going to be ending soon and you have to figure out what you're going to do next. And I think I'm going to learn a ton. I am learning a ton about job market, about economy, about opportunities that do exist and that don't exist for employment for folks in our community. And I mean, more importantly, I think what I'm valuing about this role is a chance to just have like heart-to-heart conversations with people about what are their hopes and dreams for their life, what are the skills that they're interested in utilizing, and really thinking about things through a skills-based lens of, again, we all have something that we're good at and something that is of value to contribute to the world. And I think in our culture, our job is really one of those great ways that we get to share those skills and utilize them to help make those connections with employers and individuals is going to be pretty fun. That's my day job, but it's also giving me a little more capacity to do some other things I love, like parenting and community singing and just a lot of other ways that I like to be in the world as just a person.
The name of the organization, Avivo?
Yeah, A-V-I-V-O.
Is that an acronym or is it Spanish word for to live or I live? What does it come from?
I think the origin is actually the Spanish word I live. The motto is live well, work well. That's the hope for all of us really in community.
Well, you're doing such a great job of helping the world live, people live beyond transactional. I feel like your work has been very graceful. And I've loved seeing what you've been doing with Friends for Nonviolent World. This sounds like an exciting new avenue forward. I hope it enriches your entire community, as well as your nuclear family, as well as your religious family, as well as the entire world. And thank you for devoting yourself to that with such joy and for joining me here today for Spirit in Action.
And my pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much for the chance to have this conversation.
And folks, I'll have links to fnvw.org, AVP, other organizations, including Avivo. I'll have that all on northernspiritradio.org with this program. We'll see you next week for Spirit in Action.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.